Okay, so today I'll be talking about gravitational waves from oscillation modes in neutron stars, and in particular from the R-mode instability in neutron stars. My collaborators on the work I'll talk about today were Anna Flanagan, Ira Wasserman, and Saul Tucholsky at Cornell, Katrina Schenk at UCSF, and Sharon Morsink at Alberta. Okay, so the outline for the talk is first review observations of neutron star spins as motivation for the R-mode instability. The possible role of gravitational waves might play in setting the spins of neutron stars. And then we'll talk about the basics of the R-mode instability and also some recent developments. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is determinations of spin frequencies in neutron stars from burst oscillations in type 1 X-ray bursts, and also from the accreting millisecond pulsars. Okay, so the systems we're looking at here are binary systems with a low-mass solar companion and a neutron star. The neutron stars tend to be very weakly magnetized. We think that because of the absence of pulsation from them. And so we expect the accretion disk is actually extending down very close to the neutron star. Now, theoretically, we think that neutron stars can actually rotate above 1,000 hertz. Okay? And so how much mass would we have to accrete before we could spin the neutron star up to that 1,000 hertz spin frequency? And it turns out it only takes a very small amount of mass, about a tenth of a solar mass. Okay, you could ask, how much time will it take to spin the neutron star up to kilohertz rotation frequency? If you're accreting at a 10th Eddington, it only take of order 10 to the 8 years. If you're accreting at Eddington, 10 to the 7 years. Okay, so much shorter than the age of these systems. So theoretically then, we expect that we should see neutron stars rotating extremely rapidly of order a kilohertz. Okay, what do we actually see? One way of measuring spin frequencies the last 6 or 7 years is using burst oscillations in type 1 X-ray bursts. Okay, so type 1 X-ray bursts are basically thermonuclear explosions on the surfaces of neutron stars. Okay, when the accreted matter falls onto the neutron star, it builds up in a layer and eventually becomes unstable and explodes. Okay, so the typical luminosities you see from these bursts are of order Eddington, and they'll last for 10 to 100 seconds. And what we see in these bursts is that there's actually pulsations in the light coming from the burst. Okay, so we can use those pulsations to measure the spin frequency. So the basic idea for where we think these pulsations are coming from is that there's some sort of hot spot on the star, and then the star is rotating, and so as the hot spot comes in and out of view, we're getting more and less flux. Okay, so down here what we show is there's two different things on this plot. What this line shows is the light curve for how much light you're getting as a function of time during the burst. Okay, this one lasts for about 20 seconds. And then on this axis, we see the Fourier transform of the light curve telling us what is this pulsation frequency. Okay, and so you can see the pulsation frequency actually drifts a little bit. It starts off down here at 329 hertz and then drifts up by order 1 or 2 hertz and then becomes relatively constant in the tail. Okay, now it's this frequency which you're observing out here in the tail, which is interesting because it tends to be the same to high accuracy from one burst to another. Okay, and it also tends to stay the same over a year-long time scales. Okay, so it's very stable, and this has led people to think that this is actually a measurement of the spin frequency of neutron stars. Okay, and so this has been done for 11 sources now, and they observe a remarkably narrow range of spin frequencies in between 300 to 600 hertz. Okay, so you're expecting you get something above 1,000 hertz, but you're not seeing that by an order factor of 2.
Is that the spin frequency where it's it's only a few hertz?
Okay, there's actually a conference going on right now to discuss this evolution that you see during the burst. It's not a settled question yet, as far as I know. In addition to the burst oscillations as a frequency measurement, we finally found accreting millisecond pulsars. Okay, so in these neutron stars, you think there is a bit bigger of a magnetic field, and so the accretion gets channeled onto the neutron star in certain places, creating hot spots, and then you can see pulsation from that. For the three accreting millisecond pulsars, again, you're seeing low spin rates. Okay, So in all the accreting systems that we have here, we'll have spin rates. Now, if you're wondering, do the burst oscillations agree, give you the same spin frequencies as you have in the, from these persistent pulse, from the pulsars? For SACS-J1808, it has both burst oscillations and a persistent pulse, and they agree. All right, so here's an inventory of spin frequencies in neutron stars. And there's a few different compilations here. So basically spin frequency and then how many neutron stars you have. Okay, so the red line here are the spin frequencies I just showed you from burst oscillations and accreting millisecond pulsars. So you see, again, it cuts off at 600 hertz, and there's a little bit of a tail to low frequencies. Okay, now the other two curves in green and purple here are for radio pulsars. Okay, the green curve here is a sample of 20 millisecond pulsars found in one globular cluster, 47 TUC, by Camille et al. Okay, and so these the spin frequencies for these pulsars cut off of order 475 hertz, a bit below where you see the accretors. The purple line here is taken from Manchester's catalog of all radio pulsars, including the ones found in the recent Park survey. Okay, so you can see, I mean, because this is all radio pulsars, you know, ever found, they have a much larger sample, but again, it's cutting off at the same point. Okay, so this is the question. Where are these neutron stars? Why aren't we seeing neutron stars over here with spin rates above 1,000 hertz, or even in between of order 600 to 1,000? Okay, one. It's 600 hertz. It's roughly the same. I don't remember, it's 600 something. Yeah. Okay, well, so one question you might ask is, can we actually detect these very short frequency, very short period pulsars? Okay, so again, this is the sample of 20 millisecond pulsars from Camille, and what I have here is, again, the same plot of how many pulsars you have as a function of period. Okay, and again, there's the lack of pulsars below 2 milliseconds. Down here is essentially the efficiency, or what's the minimum flux that you could detect. Okay, so this is at 20 centimeters, which is where they're most sensitive. Okay, what you can see is that in between 2 to 3 milliseconds, and in between 1 to 2 milliseconds, the minimum flux is actually only changing by about 30%. Okay, so in between 2 to 3, you see 5 pulsars, but you know, you should expect to see some down here at 1 to 2. You know, the efficiency hasn't decreased by orders of magnitude. You know, it's just a small factor. So why aren't you seeing any pulsars down here? Okay, so one model for what sets the spin rates of neutron stars in accreting systems is magnetic accretion. So basically, a neutron star has a good-sized magnetic field so that the magnetosphere extends away from the star, okay, and it truncates the accretion disk out at some distance. So what will happen then is that the accreting material will spin up the neutron star until roughly it co-rotates with the material at the inner edge of the disk, which is at the boundary of this magnetosphere. Okay, so you can estimate the equilibrium spin period that you would expect once it's been spun up to that rate, and it's going to scale roughly as this power of b and the mass accretion rate m dot. Okay, so now we can ask, how does this compare with the data? Okay, so what we found is that the spin frequency is roughly the same for these accreting systems. For the LMXBs, you know, it's within a factor of 2, and it's over 3 orders of magnitude in m dot. Okay, and so since b, so if we set this equal to a constant, b is going to go like square root of m dot. And so what that would imply is that since we have 3 orders of magnitude in m dot, then the magnetic field we would expect is varying by a factor of 30. Okay, but here's the problem. Okay, so we know we have this magnetic field there. We know it's extending away from the star. And when material comes off the disk onto the star, why aren't we seeing a persistent pulse in most LMXBs? Okay, we see it in the 3 accreting millisecond pulsars, but not in most LMXBs. And if the magnetic field is varying by this orders of magnitude, how are you hiding the pulse? Okay, so this is the basic problem with magnetic accretion. And so this has led people to look at other ways in which you could halt the spin-up of neutron stars in accreting binaries. So the first thing I want to talk about is perhaps the standard scenario, for, I won't say standard, but it's the first thing proposed. So what Bildsen has proposed is that, imagine you have a neutron star, it's rotating like this, and it has a little bump on it, some little non-axisymmetric perturbation on the star. Okay, so when this bump is swinging around, it can radiate gravitational waves. And so if you balance the spin-down torque from gravitational waves with the spin-up torque due to accretion, then what this will tell you is how big the quadrupole you need in order to balance these two torques. And it turns out you just need some very small asymmetry of order of part in 10 to the 7 in order to balance the two torques for typical spin rates and accretion rates for the LMXBs. Okay, now the interesting thing for gravitational waves is if you know that you're emitting all these gravitational waves to apply the torque on the star, okay, then you can ask how detectable are those gravitational waves? Okay, so from the usual quadrupole formula, you can rewrite this in a interesting way by expressing the distance in terms of m dot and then in terms of the flux, and you can end up with a formula for the strain which you observe at Earth in terms of the X-ray flux which you're observing from this source, and also the spin frequency. Okay, and so it's an interesting range of strain. I mean, it's for LIGO. So basically, what you have to do then is you just look out in the sky, find these accreting sources, measure their X-ray flux. If you see, for instance, a burst oscillation, then you know both of these quantities, and you have an estimate of the strain that you should observe. Okay, so from this, we would expect that, you know, if there's a bump on the star, little mountains on the star, which are halting the spin up, then we should expect to see, you know, order 10 of these sources with LIGO. Okay, another method which has been proposed, which I'll talk about for the rest of this talk, is the R-mode instability. Okay, so the statement of the R-mode instability is actually very simple. Okay, all rotating stars with zero viscosity are unstable to a general relativistic instability, which will tend to spin the star down. So it's interesting. Any star, okay, as long as you make this one assumption. Okay, so the way that this instability works is I have my rotating star here. Now imagine that there's some non-axisymmetric perturbation on this star, which when you view it from an inertial frame looks like it's going prograde, and when you view it from a frame co-rotating with a star looks like it's going retrograde. Okay, so the mode would have negative angular momentum. Okay, so what it means is that when you radiate positive angular momentum from this positive pattern speed in the inertial frame, the only way you can conserve angular momentum is if the angular momentum of the R mode becomes more negative. Okay, and since it has negative angular momentum, this means its amplitude is growing. All right, so this is the basic source of the instability. So this was the instability that was first realized by Chandrasekhar, Friedman, and Schütz in a more general context. And it was Anderson who realized that there's this special class of modes in neutron stars called R modes, which are actually unstable at all rotation rates, okay, in the absence of viscosity. Previously, people had looked at modes which would only be unstable above some threshold rotation rate, which is actually very large. Okay, so what do R modes look like? So basically, if this is your star, and this is the direction of gravity, R modes are mostly horizontal motion, okay? So there's not much vertical motion. Okay, so they're motion on spheres. There's not much compression going on, as you would have in a sound wave. And if you were looking at the star, you would see this sort of pattern of flow velocity like this, and it would be rotating around the star. Okay, it looks like little twisty things. Okay, and this the amplitude of the mode, at least for simple stellar models, for this horizontal movement, would tend to increase towards the surface, at least in simple stellar models. Okay, so now we discussed a little bit of what is the R mode instability. When will it actually occur in real stars? Okay, in real stars, you're going to have driving due to this gravitational radiation, which would tend to exponentially increase the amplitude of the mode. Okay, but you're also going to have damping due to viscosity. Okay, and so what you need to know is for a real star, what are the sources of viscosity? And for a given spin rate, okay, the gravitational radiation reaction goes like a high power spin rate. And for a given temperature, because the bulk and shear viscosities depend on temperature, like this, you want to know when is the mode going to be unstable. Okay, so what you can do is sort of this fundamental diagram for R modes is you can, on the plane of spin frequency versus temperature, you can draw a line at which these two rates balance. Okay, so driving equals damping on this line. Okay, so if you're anywhere above this line, okay, you're going to be in the regime where the R mode is being driven and its amplitude will rise exponentially. Okay, so as soon as you're above this line, unstable rise the amplitude until it saturates through some mechanism. Okay, so when people first did calculations of the viscosities in neutron stars and how they affect R modes, they saw something interesting for the basic calculations, which I'll call sort of the standard scenario, where you're including just the simple bulk and shear viscosities. So what they saw is that the LMXBs would actually be sitting fairly close to this instability curve. Okay, so LMXBs tend to have a temperature of order 10 to the 8 degrees in the core, and the temperature is set by nuclear reactions which occur in this accreted material. And we just saw that their spin frequencies are over 300 to 600 hertz, which is actually lying fairly close to this, the initial determination for where this instability curve would lie. Okay, so the idea then is that if you have an accreting a neutron star, which is accreting material, it'll be spun up until it hits the instability curve. Okay, and then the way that the R mode instability would work is the amplitude would grow, you'd begin to radiate lots of angular momentum and gravitational waves, and that would start to counteract the torque so that you couldn't move the you couldn't move the spin frequency up much more than that. Okay, the spin frequency would be limited to be somewhere near this curve. Okay, so that was the basic idea initially. Okay, now this also has implications for young neutron stars, which were just born in a supernova. Young neutron stars would begin life at around 10 to the 11 degrees and would rapidly cool in to the instability curve over here. Okay, after that point, the amplitude of the R mode would grow, you'd radiate gravitational waves, and spin the star down. Okay, to some point down here where it would exit the instability curve. Okay, so the fundamental observable effect of R modes is that you shouldn't expect to see neutron stars up here. Okay, you should only expect to see neutron stars basically outside of this instability curve. Okay, so down here somewhere. Okay, so they would basically be limiting the spins by forcing observable stars to be in this region, because if they ever went up here, they would just get spun down again very quickly. So that's the basic idea. Owen et al. Made simple estimates for how much gravitational waves are emitted by these R modes. They tend to radiate not by the ordinary mass quadrupole, but by the mass current quadrupole, the rho v part. And so you get an extra power of velocity right here. And in addition, the strain that you would observe at Earth also depends on the amplitude of the mode. Basically, what's the size of this horizontal movement as compared to the radius of the star? Okay, so initial calculations for this, showed right away there was an interesting gravitational wave source, even for neutron stars which were of order, 10 megaparsec away, if it was rotating at a kilohertz and you had large amplitude wave. Okay, and so this was the initial excitement for the R mode instability. Now, for accreting systems, LMXBs, if the accretion torque can be stably balanced by the R mode gravitational wave torque, okay, then basically what you're going to be doing is recovering the simple estimate we made a minute ago, where the gravitational, where the strain that you observe at Earth just depends on the flux that you observe from this neutron star. Okay, and what that means is that the amplitude will just adjust in order to make these two torques be the same. Okay? But it turns out that it's not guaranteed that these two torques can just balance each other and stay in equilibrium. Okay, so if these two torques don't balance each other, the amplitude of the mode and the size of the gravitational waves you're observing is going to be set by some other process, which is most likely hydrodynamics. So the fact that you may not be in some stable equilibrium actually has important observational consequences for if you can actually observe the gravitational waves. And Yuri Levin was the first person to realize this. And the statement of it is, if the viscosity in the star decreases as a function of temperature, then you won't tend to get this stable equilibrium. You'll tend to get a runaway. Okay, and the way that this runaway works is in our plane of temperature versus spin frequency, the neutron star is being spun up by accretion. It goes over the instability curve, and the mode becomes unstable, grows to large amplitude. Okay, but when it does that, it's going to start to dissipate some of its mechanical energy into heat in the star. Okay, and that means you're moving to the right in this diagram. Okay, but if you heat the star, the viscosity decreases, and that means that driving is increasing over damping. The mode is becoming more and more unstable. Okay, so the mode becomes grows to larger amplitude, it moves more this way, and so you get this runaway where you're heating and the mode is growing to ever larger amplitude until you reach some sort of saturation state again. And then and the effect, the end effect will be is that the mode, the gravitational waves will rapidly spin the star down, and you'll exit the instability curve, you know, somewhere down here. The neutron star would then cool and begin this cycle of accretion again. Okay, so what Levin realized is that the time that it takes to spin up the star due to accretion is long. It's of order 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 years. Okay, but the time that it takes to spin down during this part of the cycle is actually very short. If you had an order unity amplitude mode, you would spin down in of order 1 year, less than a year. Okay, and so the duty cycle for emitting gravitational waves is how much time you spend here versus how much time you spend here for order unity amplitude mode. This was, you know, a part in a million or a part in 10 million. Okay, and so what this meant is that you were sort of unlikely to observe gravitational waves from any source because the duty cycle is small. Okay, then the question is, how many sources do you have? Do you have enough sources to overcome this small duty cycle? Since there are of order 100 LMXBs in the galaxy, you need a duty cycle of order 10 to the minus 2 to see at least one source. Okay, and so what this is going to depend on actually is how long do you spend in this part of the in the instability region? Okay, and that'll depend sensitively on the mode amplitude. And I should also mention some recent work by Heil, where he's actually tried to see how many sources you would expect to be observable as a function of some arbitrary duty cycle. Okay, so now that we realize that the actual size of the mode amplitude is important because it tells you how fast you're going to be spinning down and what the duty cycle for observing gravitational waves is, let me talk a little bit about what the saturation amplitude is expected to be. Okay, so the first work on this was by Lindblom, Tolleen, and Vallisneri, who did hydrodynamical simulations of rotating stars, including the effect of a gravitational radiation reaction force. Okay, so what they saw in the simulation is that they would actually see R modes growing with time, and they actually saw them grow so large in the simulations that you would see basically large waves appear on the surface which would break, and you would get shock heating of the fluid near the surface. Okay, so in this simulation, the way that the mode saturated, the way it stopped growing more, is through basically shocks taking kinetic energy and putting into thermal energy. Okay, and in this case, the mode saturated at an amplitude of order the stellar radius, you know, very large. One aspect of the simulation which my collaborators and I were interested in looking at is in order for the simulation to run in a finite time, they had to boost up the size of the gravitational radiation reaction force to be several thousand times what it would actually be in nature. Okay, and so one question is, if you're driving it a little bit more weakly, would you actually get these large amplitude features appearing and shocks occurring? Okay, so would the mode still be saturated by shocks? And so what my collaborators and I looked at is, assuming that the amplitude would be small, we looked at saturation by energy transfer to other oscillation modes in the star. Okay, so there's the R mode ringing around in the star, and then there are all these other types of oscillation modes. In particular, we looked at the so-called inertial modes, which would appear in rapidly rotating stars. Inertial modes are basically how they're restoring force from the Coriolis force. So the basic idea is that the R mode, you know, sort of running into other waves, it can transfer energy to those other waves. And if it can transfer energy fast enough, then it can saturate the instability. It turns out you can estimate this in a simple way. The rate at which you input energy into the R mode is going to look something like this rate times the amplitude of the mode. Okay, the rate at which you take energy out of the mode by nonlinear processes would be quadratic in the amplitude of the mode, and then it'll depend on some frequency. And when you look in detail at the size of the nonlinear coupling forces, this frequency ends up being of order the rotation frequency of the star. So if we equate driving to effective damping for this mode, then what we find is the R mode will saturate at this fraction of the rotation rate of the star. Okay, and that fraction scales as basically V over C to the fifth, will be the rotation rate of the star. Okay, so from this semi-analytic work, it seems like the saturation amplitude will be small. If we crank up the radiation reaction force by a factor of a few thousand, this energy in the R mode is actually, you know, give you order unity amplitude wave in the star. So it may agree with the Lindblom et al. Simulations. Other people are actually doing simulations to investigate the nonlinear saturation in more detail. But it's interesting to ask, if you use the saturation amplitude that we found here, what are the observable consequences? Okay, for one thing, if you had a neutron star which was just born rapidly rotating in a supernova, okay, the distance out to which you could detect that neutron star gravitational waves is actually a bit smaller now, but because the amplitude is smaller and it's emitting less gravitational waves, basically by of order this factor. The time that it takes to spin down now, the time that you're inside this instability curve in radiating gravitational waves in the accreting systems, instead of being of order 1 year, because of the smaller amplitude now, it'll be of order 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 years. Okay, but basically, instead of a duty cycle of part in 10 to the 7, this would imply a duty cycle of 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, okay, which is still fairly small. And since you only have 100 LMXPs in the galaxy, you might need to look outside the galaxy in order to see more sources. And again, so the question of, for the LMXBs, the question of whether or not you can actually observe the gravitational waves really depends sensitively on what's the duty cycle as it's in Levin's limit cycle, okay? And there's still work ongoing in this regard, basically having to do with what is the viscosity in the neutron star, and would you actually expect it to be undergoing this limit cycle, or would you expect it to be in stable equilibrium? Okay, so let me discuss some recent work by Lindblom and Owen, which is motivated by a paper by Jones in 2001. Okay, so there's a new bulk viscosity process which was only recently realized would be important in neutron stars. Basically, bulk viscosity is when you squeeze the material. Okay, there will be some sort of dissipated process which will take mechanical energy and dissipate it as heat. Okay, so the way it works here is when you squeeze the material, you'll be turning the two neutrons into a proton and a hyperon. Okay, but the pressure that's supplied by these two particles is different than the pressure supplied by those two particles. And so relative to an adiabat, you have some small pressure perturbation over the cycle of compression and rarefaction. Okay, so if you integrate up the PdV work that you get from these small changes in pressure and you calculate a viscosity from that, it turns out the viscosity you get for these two processes involving hyperons are just orders of magnitude larger than previous viscosities people had discussed for neutron stars from the modified Erka process. And so they derived a new instability curve using this viscosity. So what you see here is the mass of the star. Okay, and then you see different instability curves for different masses of the star. Basically, as you go to heavier stars, you'll tend to have more hyperons, and so the emission, the dissipation that you get from this process will be much greater. Okay, but the effect is here, I mean, previously the instability curve extended way down over here. Okay, so that stars could go unstable down at much lower temperatures. But if this bulk viscosity is actually working, it's going to limit the range in which R modes can be unstable and spin stars down to be in this very narrow range of temperature, basically above a few by 10 to the 9. Okay, so this is bad news for the LMXBs. Okay, so that if you use this viscosity for LMXBs, you wouldn't think that they would actually be unstable. Okay, but recently a paper by Wagner appeared in which he discusses the likely values of what the superfluid transition temperatures would be for the neutrons and protons. And basically, if superfluid suppression could knock down this bulk viscosity by a fair amount. Okay, and so what Wagner had done then was take the bulk viscosity calculated by Lindblom and Owen, apply a superfluid suppression factor, which knocks it down by a fair amount. And the interesting thing that he found was that for the LMXBs, he actually found that there was a stable balance between spin up by accretion and spin down by radiation reaction. Okay, which again is interesting for gravitational waves. Okay. So I want to say about that. Okay, so I'll end a little bit early here. Why are R modes interesting? R modes may be responsible for setting the maximum rotation rate of neutron stars. And the work my collaborators and I had done recently was to investigate what is the size of the saturation amplitude for R modes. We had found that it's fairly small. The effects of this would be that only nearby supernovae would produce detectable gravitational radiation from R modes. The situation for LMXBs is actually, I don't think it's quite settled yet. More work probably needs to be done on what is the actual viscosity in the stars. Basically, if this new hyperon bulk viscosity is really the viscosity which is occurring in the star, then the R mode for LMXBs, the R mode idea is probably just completely killed off. But if there are high transition temperatures for superfluid, and you get large superfluid suppression in this hyperon viscosity, as Wagner noted, then they may remain a promising source for LIGO. Okay, thank you.
As to which of these options occurs, because you'd expect a pileup wherever the curve has a minimum at that period for which there is a minimum and the pulsars, right?
They may not end up at the minimum, it turns out. As they're spinning down, if the R mode is inputting a substantial amount of heat into the star, then you may end up at every spin frequency, you may end up at an equilibrium temperature set by heating from the R mode versus cooling by whatever process. And that the place that equilibrium temperature curve hits the instability strip may not be at the minimum. So actually you would expect the pileup to be where the equilibrium temperature curve hits the instability curve.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Bill again.